Hey, this is Shahid Chaudhary, Senior Technical Evangelist at Microsoft. We're here to learn about web application security and vulnerabilities such as SQL injection and cross-site scripting. To get a hold of the presentation material, you may visit my blog, wakeupandcode.com. You may also reach out to me via Twitter. My Twitter handle there is @ShahidC, which is my first name and my last initial. Our agenda for today, we'll start off with an overview of web application security, and then we'll jump into some specific vulnerabilities such as SQL injection and cross-site scripting. We'll touch briefly on some data exposure issues, and finally, we'll wrap up with the next steps for your web application security. If you've attended a live event, I usually have Q&A at the end. I do take questions throughout the event. Since this is a pre-recorded video, you can set your questions aside for now and make sure you get in touch with me by Twitter or even my email address, which I'll provide at the end of this presentation. Here's the simplest version of a web application that I came up with. You have your users that are happy on one end. You have your web server that's providing your data, maybe with a backend database via the internet. But you may not know who all your users are. You could have some malicious users in there who are more than happy to attack your site and even make it unusable and cause problems for other users and you as well. So to get around this, we're going to learn about some top vulnerabilities and how it works in the real world. Let's start with SQL injection. SQL injection is as simple as injecting SQL or structured query language statements within a form on your web application. It could be as simple as entering the code and commands in the password field and then getting to your system, maybe even shutting it down and accessing your system without your knowledge. So let's say you would typically enter your username and password in a field like this. But instead of entering a password, a malicious user could then attach some commands. What does all this mean? You'll see this apostrophe or single quote character followed by an OR statement where it says 1 equals 1, followed by a pound sign, or whatever character is used as the comment character for this database system that you're using. What this does is it tries to create a condition which is always true, and then it ensures that your login is always successful regardless of what password you enter. To see a quick demo of this, we're going to use the SQL injection demo that's available for the public at codebashing.com. It's a third-party site that I found online, and they have a great SQL demo that you can try out. So let's jump out of the presentation and jump directly into a web browser. So we'll go into a web browser. And as this is loading, you'll see that they have a login for this website called Trade Portal, which is a sample site which you can start your demo in. I'll go ahead and click on the Start button that they're provided, and here, I'm going to click Next to go ahead and enter a username and password. So now they've suggested that I entered a username and maybe a potential password. So I'll go ahead and enter those values. So now I click Login, and then my login has failed. You'll see it says there's an error, there's an invalid username and password. And the typical query for this would be it's trying to select a data value from the user table, which is in the database, for an email address, which is our login, and the password value that's being passed in. If that doesn't exist, you get an error code. This is very typical of most websites with logins. But remember, we have to add an apostrophe or a single quote character to bypass the system and inject some SQL in there. So let's see how that works. So again, we're going to go back to the web browser. And this time, let's add the user back in and add a password value. And we'll add an apostrophe towards the end. So again, you can see that I've added an apostrophe character. Let's try to log in with that. And now we're getting some sort of error. So let's see what that says. So the error that it's saying is that there is some strange character there. Maybe their syntax is wrong. So we've essentially discovered that it's not sanitizing the user input. Or in other words, it's taking the user input as is and trying to process that semicolon. So what if we could actually do more with it? So let's try and go back to login. And I'm going to enter the same value again. But this time, again, continue to use the demo on here. Let's look through some of the code that's available. So the code over here shows me that I have two lines of code that gets the email and the password, and then generates a SQL statement. So the SQL statement select star from users, where email and password have certain values that are being passed in, is a typical select statement that you would use to get the user and password value from the form. So what happens is, if I can go ahead and focus on those specific lines of code, the query is executed based on the user values that are entered. But what if the user value has additional special characters that makes the system think that there's more SQL statements right after it? So first thing you'll notice is the email and password fields have single quotes around them. So if I add a single quote in the password, it acts as if the password field is blank and then continues to add in additional values. We'll show you what it means. So in this time, we're going to go ahead and simplify the code. So they're focusing on what really matters. So again, if we look at the single line of code that's highlighted, we're focusing on the SQL statement that's being generated. Again, notice that the password field ends and begins with a single quote. So we're going to take the password input and make the system think that we've ended that SQL statement, and we're going to add additional code after it. So let's go ahead and add the magic statement right after it. So we'll go ahead and add in this Alice user again. And this time we'll see that the code below is actually getting updated. So code gets updated to show what the SQL statement will look like. It just shows the user Alice. So again, I can enter any user I want. And the password, I'm going to try to enter again Alice123, but put two semicolons in it. So as you see, the code down here shows you that the semicolons get added to the end of the SQL statement. So that means that I could add additional commands right after it, and it'll try to run those as actual SQL queries. So I'm going to try and log in as that. And again, it's not able to log in. But what if I could add the special character that has an OR statement in it? So what it'll do, it'll say, hey, try and select any user that has this specific username and this specific password, or whenever 1 equals 1, this statement is always true. So what that means is that even if the password is not correct and the user authentication should fail, the second part of it, which it says, or 1 equals 1, will always evaluate to true. So this results in an always true statement, and this will allow the system to log the user in. So let's go ahead and add that special character statement in there. So once again, I'll just enter this alice@bank.com, and then this time I'll put a special character in there, or, and then put in 1 equals 1, close it, and put a double quote or a pound sign in there for this specific system. So what happens is that if you look down at the bottom, since the password is being masked, you can see that I have the full SQL statements where username is alice@bank.com and the password is an empty string of two single quotes followed by or 1 equals 1. So this means that the SQL statement will always return true. So now I can go ahead and run the statement. But what is the pound sign there for? So the pound sign is there to comment out whatever follows the SQL statement that's being written. Since the developer of this original code close the SQL statement with a single quote and a parenthesis, what it does is it comments out the rest of it, so the 1 equals 1 becomes valid SQL code. Let's actually run it and see what that means. So I'll go ahead and click log me in, and now I've successfully logged into the system. So now I've logged into the system, and by running this sample demo version in at codebashing.com, we've been able to evaluate what it looks like to run SQL injection. So again, thanks to the folks at codebashing.com, they've been able to set up this limited demo version that illustrates really well what SQL injection does. So what does that mean for you? Let's go back to the presentation and move on. We just saw a quick demo of it, but it also helps to know that this is going on in the real world. I've come up with some news articles from recent months. So this is from late 2015 that talks about attackers targeting Joomla sites through SQL injection. So Joomla is, again, a very popular PHP-based content management system, similar to Drupal or WordPress. Here's another article that is also pretty recent. It's from late 2015. It talks about Joomla SQL injection flaws being used in attacks. And then we have another article on the history of SQL injection, something that apparently never goes away because hackers seem to exploit it wherever there's a vulnerability. And finally, a BBC News article about a popular app named TalkTalk, whose website was hit with a significant breach. So again, there are some links over there. If you download the presentation material from my blog, wakeupandcode.com, you can see more details. But this goes to show you that this is a real life problem. It does happen. Towards the end, we'll cover the kind of solutions we'll have for each of these problems. So let's jump into this one right now for a SQL injection. The easiest way to avoid SQL injection problems is to avoid SQL strings within your parameters. If you don't have SQL strings that take parameters, you won't have SQL injection problems. Obviously, this may not be possible in every case. You might need to take in some user input. So you could encode your user input, or in some cases, sanitize your user input so you don't take everything as is. You won't take in the apostrophe character. That way, you won't be able to run SQL injection through user input fields. And finally, use framework-specific features. So whether you're doing something in ASP.NET or PHP or any other programming language or framework that you use, this is a problem that's existed for a long time. Take a look at the documentation and work done by the developers of the frameworks you're using, and make sure that you're up to speed on how to avoid SQL injection for those specific items. So again, we won't go into detail on each specific type of technology. There are a lot of different web technologies, but if you're interested in Microsoft's ASP.NET framework, you can go ahead and try docs.asp.net. Again, it's a documentation site that is open source for the all new ASP.NET. One good thing to know is Microsoft has a framework called Entity Framework, which allows you to interact with your database. And using Entity Framework, you can pair it with your ASP.NET code to make it easier to bypass any vulnerabilities that you would normally get with SQL injection. Next, we have cross-site scripting. In this case, I have a very simple form. I have some text that you might want to enter. Let's say you hit submit and you're displaying it on the page itself. This kind of form is really popular on websites like YouTube, where people are submitting comments, maybe on Facebook and other social media, where data values submitted from any user in the world can be displayed to all other users. But what if you could submit some script code as well? Let's take a look at a real life example. So the demo example we'll show you today is provided by Google, and they have a very simple basic example on running an XSS demo. So you might be wondering, why is cross-site scripting called XSS? That's because CSS is already taken as cascading style sheets. That's for styling web pages. So XSS is the common acronym for cross-site scripting. Now that the demo page is loaded, let's try the demo application here. So as suggested, we can enter some test values, click search, and here it says no results were found for test values. Well, let's click try again. So one of the suggestions they'll say is, you know, what if you could enter some HTML code here, maybe with the underline tag. So the U tag is for underlining test. So test values, click search again. And we'll notice that the values that come back, test values actually underlined here. So that means that we know the system is not only storing this text temporarily, but it's also processing any HTML code. So one of the suggestions that you'll see on Google's page is it talks about putting in some script code in there. We can put in an alert statement that will have a little pop-up that comes up. So let's try again. I'll just copy and paste this code to make it a little easier. So it starts off with a script tag followed by the alert call with some text that'll pop up. And then it wraps up with /script to close that script tag. So I'm going to go ahead and delete that period at the end. So let's see what happens when I run this. Click search. And now it says, sorry, no results were found for. And there's nothing at the end because the script tag is actually being processed by the browser. And this pop-up comes up and it says, hello. So that means now we've processed some values and the browser actually runs it. So what does this mean for you as a web developer? Let's say you have a website like Facebook or even YouTube, And you allow anyone to enter not only HTML code, but also script tags to run any sort of JavaScript. In the worst case, you could have someone being redirected to another malicious website, or you could have people just being annoyed by pop-ups and other useless values that are coming up. So again, this can be a minor annoyance or very dangerous for your website. So let's go back to our slides and see what it's like to have cross-thread scripting in the real world. Here's an article. This is from early 2016. And it says that 87% of open source vulnerabilities are cross-site scripting and SQL injections. That's pretty bad. That's a lot of vulnerabilities that we have. And we do have a lot of open source systems that are being used by companies and nonprofits and students, startups all over the world. Here's another article that talks about SQL injection being used to manipulate search engine results. That doesn't sound too good either. And again, another article about SQL injection and cross-site scripting flaws found in network management system products. So this goes back to show you that, again, cross-site scripting and SQL injection are pretty dangerous out there, and we definitely don't want to be affected by them. And if you want to click on the links and see details, again, download the slides at wakeupandcode.com so you can see more details yourself. But first, let's focus on solutions for cross-site scripting. HTML encode your script tags. If you don't want the user to be able to run scripts on your website and have other people affected by it, you can just HTML encode them, which actually changes the angle brackets to ampersand symbols that shows you the characters as is on the screen. So what does that mean? If you've HTML encoded your script tags, or any HTML tags for that matter, the tags will be shown as they're entered instead of being processed by the browser. So again, this depends on your own code, the language that you use, the approach will be different, but the idea is the same, to HTML encode your script tags. You could strip out script tags. Maybe you don't need the user to enter HTML or other tags in your code. You could strip them out, and whenever the user enters something, you can only show the main text that they've entered, and anything within tags will be stripped out. And finally, based on the framework that you're using, use framework-specific features. Again, for Microsoft ASP.NET framework, there are some practices that you can use to make sure you leave out cross-site scripting. Check out the Microsoft ASP.NET documentation at docs.asp.net to learn more about it. And finally, we come to data exposure. So let's say we have another simple form, very similar to what we've seen before, but let's say we perform an action that causes an error. Let's say we enter some special characters in the field and it causes an error, and suddenly we're exposing maybe a server name, a database name, the name of some code file, and maybe even a line number. That is way too much information for an end user to see. So how do you get around this? Here's some solutions I would suggest. Just don't display any unnecessary details at all. Maybe you don't want the user to see all that extra information. It's really, really dangerous because they could then hack into your system, maybe if they find out more information about it, or at least discover additional vulnerabilities. You could log the errors in a database, because not displaying the details doesn't make the error go away. Maybe you'd like to know about the errors. So definitely in the backend code, log the errors in a database or maybe a file somewhere that's it's persistent, so you can check out the errors later on. And finally, provide some sort of error code for troubleshooting later. Maybe the user will see a friendly error message with an error code, and they can use that to maybe get tech support for your application. So again, there are different ways to find solutions around this, but you definitely do not want to expose way too much data than what's needed. So the next steps I would suggest is take a look at the OWASP top 10. It hasn't been updated regularly, but the top 10 that they have right now is pretty useful. You can find things like injection and cross-site scripting in there. All sorts of injection methods are discussed, but SQL injection, again, being one of the more popular ones. Again, there's a top 10 list. You can view the additional details on their website at OWASP.org. And then there are some commercial tools. These are enterprise tools by HP. The one I'd like to point out are the WebInspect and Fortify family. You can get some dynamic analysis or static analysis. And the difference between the two is that dynamic analysis will test your code as it's running, or static analysis will test your code even without having to run your application. So again, there's different ways that you can run these. Now, why would I go ahead and select one specific set of tools from HP? if you take a look at the what's called the Gartner Magic Quadrant, now Gartner provides Magic Quadrants for all sorts of applications. This is specifically for application security testing. So Gartner provides this data based on all the research I've done by trying out lots of different products from different companies. HP, by a large margin, happens to be the leader in this area. And they have not only completeness of vision, but also ability to execute. So let me zoom in on that so you can see really quick. There's HP all the way in the top left, or top right, rather. So now that you've seen this, you know that HP has built some good products that are being used by enterprises around the world. So whether you're a student who's about to get your first internship, or you're graduating from school, or you've been working in application development for a while, and you'd like some recommendations, you can try out their free trials and then see if that's a product that's right for you. I do mention the other product names on the screen as well. There's IBM and some other companies you may recognize. So again, try what's right for you. Try out some free trials. Make sure that it works within your budget and you're able to test out security vulnerabilities. The reason you would want to try these tools out is that you can find not only the vulnerabilities we talked about today, but also additional things that you may not have thought of. So that wraps up our presentation about web application security. If you have any questions, since this is an online video, obviously you can't ask from the live audience, but what you can do is send me an email. And before we wrap up, let's actually show you the screen about the Student Partner Program. So since I do this presentation at various universities, there is a Student Partner Program that we have at Microsoft. It's called MSP, or Microsoft Student Partners Program. And you can use that link, MSP Apply 2016 on the top right, to go ahead and apply for the program if you're interested in running events on campus. Again, a great way to get started. But I did mention that I have my email address as well. You see in the bottom left, my email address. It's part of my first name, part of my last name, shchowd@microsoft.com. And finally, I'll leave you with my business card. You can get more information on it. Contact me directly. And don't forget to check out my blog, wakeupandcode.com, where I'll be posting the slides for this video.